and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the dangerous Trump strategy of weaponizing humanitarian aid to Venezuela in support of the opposition to turn the Venezuelan military against the Maduro government. With no sign that the corrupt leaders of the military are about to break with Maduro, but with growing concerns that the confrontations over aid stuck on the borders could spark a civil war, we will speak with Christopher Sabatini, a professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University and the founder and executive director of the new research nonprofit Global Americans. He joins us to discuss Trump's demagogic use of Venezuelan socialism in 2020 campaign political attacks against Bernie Sanders to divide Democrats, and Vice President Pence's hawkish stance at his meeting with opposition leader Juan Guaido in Colombia today. With Trump administration hawks John Bolton, Elliot Abrams, and Marco Rubio running our Venezuelan policy, today's warning by Senator Chris Murphy might foretell a forthcoming tragic U.S. foreign policy blunder like the Iraq intervention, quoting, "Venezuelans didn't just lurch into humanitarian crisis. The aid is being sent there now as part of a regime change strategy. Many are hoping that it will be the match that lights a civil war against Maduro." Then we'll go to the UK and speak with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London and author of The Future of National Development Banks. She joins us to discuss the pending loss of 10% of the UK's GDP if the Conservative government crashes out of Brexit on March the 29th, and the announcement that Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour opposition, is prepared to back the people's vote in a new Brexit referendum. Then finally, we'll examine the controversy over the Green Book winning Best Picture at last night's Academy Awards ceremony, as opposed to Spike Lee's Black Klansman, and speak with an expert on popular culture and its impact on civil rights, Rashad Robinson, the executive director of Color of Change. He joins us to discuss the positive side of diversity on display at the Oscars, as well as the reasons why some African Americans familiar with the actual Green Book in the Jim Crow South might have wanted Spike Lee's movie to win. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Christopher Sabatini, who's a professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, the founder and executive director of the new research nonprofit Global Americans, and the editor of its news and opinion website, LatinAmericaGoesGlobal.org. Dr. Sabatini was the director for Latin America and the Caribbean at the National Endowment for Democracy, and he regularly contributes to foreign affairs and foreign policy, and most recently published an article on the decline of Venezuelan and Brazilian foreign policy ambitions titled "The Sad Death of the Latin American Left." Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Sabatini.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And at this point, it's difficult to describe the Maduro government in Venezuela as representing the left because of its sheer incompetence and criminality. So how would you describe it? Because I get a lot of angry mail from American leftists for just simply covering the story. And my sense is that if you're a leftist and supporting Maduro, then you're absolutely brain dead because the Maduro is giving socialism a bad name.
Yeah, I would – a few points here, actually. The first one is I like to point out is that if you think about the modern-day left, and I count myself from the left, is Maduro doesn't stand for any of the things and this government, any of the things we count among sort of the agenda of the modern-day left. It's not pro-indigenous. In fact, the protesters who were killed on Saturday were indigenous protesters killed by the government. It's not pro-LGBT rights. In fact, one of the opposition leaders who was an LGBT activist was in prison for a while. And it's not pro-women's rights. And, of course, it's also failing miserably in the issue of reducing poverty, which, of course, is the keystone of social democracy. And we're looking at poverty rates now around 80%. We're looking at malnutrition, a widespread malnutrition, just a massive humanitarian crisis. And last, too, is this government is peppered with military officers. In fact, the true story is that in Maduro's term alone, when he was elected in 2013 until today, he's promoted more than 1,000 generals. Venezuela has more generals than all the NATO countries combined, okay? So this is a military government. It's not a leftist government. It's just a deeply corrupt Petro state that is being run largely by the military.
And my understanding is that this strategy, which doesn't appear to be working, of pressuring the military into breaking their support for Maduro, one of the reasons they're not working is that they've all been on the take and they are part of the gravy train. And two, the Cubans' intelligence services have infiltrated into the military and Sabin, the intelligence services, to the point where the Cuban tail wags the Venezuelan dog.
Yeah, that's true. So first of all, as you say, the Venezuelan military is deeply involved in both illicit markets. It actually distributes the food that comes in. So it's selling food on the black market. One of the best jobs you can have if you're in Venezuela, if you're interested in making money and not having any morals, is serving in somewhere along the border of Colombia, because there you can charge and extort narcotics traffickers and traffic in both weapons and cocaine. This particular military is loyal in part to Maduro out of for material reasons, but also out of sheer fear, because once they step down, there's a question of what will happen. There's also an issue which you implied, Ian, is asking the military to step in to foster some sort of regime change. It's a really deeply dangerous policy, whether it's Pinochet's Chile or Maduro's Venezuela or Argentina in the 1980s under the junta, or under the Peronistas. It's just simply not a prescription for a democratic process. This is a military that is not obviously blinking. And I think it's unlikely to, for the reasons that you said, and for the reasons that they fear retribution.
So Vice President Pence is in Colombia meeting with the leader of the Venezuelan opposition, Juan Guaido. President Trump has on a number of occasions talked about the military option and keeping it on the table. And that would seem to be counterintuitive and counterproductive. So what's going on here? Do we have a problem with our leadership thinking that just by simply threatening, the Venezuelan military are going to cave?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as you've implied too, this is not an issue that's black, white, that should be looked at through an ideological lens of either side, the left or the right. Because while this government, the Maduro government's not really a leftist government, a lot of the policies that seem to be the preferred policies or that this Trump administration is threatening are ones that are very deeply risky. There are two things that make it very risky. The first is they've really, after first recognizing Juan Guaido, along with 50 other governments, including genuinely leftist governments like Lenin Moreno's in Ecuador and Tabaré Vázquez's in Uruguay, what the Trump administration has done is immediately slap oil sanctions on the government of Venezuela, and then continue to talk about this military option and continue to encourage this very performative act of provocation of getting a military, humanitarian assistance, which is deeply needed given the humanitarian crisis, but doing it as a sort of an opposition move. And the problem here is that leaving the military option on the table really risks hurtling this country, the United States' policy, towards the one option they haven't mentioned. They've continued to leave on the table, which is the military option. And you get a sense sometimes that with every step, when Maduro refuses to step down and the military refuses to change sides, that we seem to be running more and more out of diplomatic options in a very, very fast order. And that's deeply troubling.
Well, if you think it through, surely, Christopher Sabatini, if it comes to that, as soon as any American troop puts one foot on Venezuelan soil, won't we have hell to pay around the world and in the neighborhood? I mean, I can't see that being in any way an option.
No, it isn't. First of all, you know, there is still a reserve of support for Maduro within Venezuela. We have to recognize this. Venezuelans themselves, not even a majority of them, want to see any U.S. military action. And there are a number of paramilitary groups called colectivos that have been organized and armed by the government that the U.S. military would have to deal with. So, first of all, this is not Panama in 1989. But in addition to that, you have the other issue does the U.S. want to lead? We've got this time for once, the U.S. is in a broader multilateral coalition of over 50 governments that have recognized Guaido, including most of the governments in Latin America. That support for U.S. policy would evaporate the moment we put U.S. military boots on the ground in Venezuela for the reasons of history that you allude to. It's never come to any good outcome when the U.S. has invaded. And the U.S. would be finding itself standing all alone in a policy that up until now has been surprisingly and refreshingly multilateral for once. But it's hugely risky. It would be hugely counterproductive. And I actually think given the complete collapse of both the economy and the state and the politicization and corruption of this military would lead to consequences we can't even imagine. And this isn't even Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This is a far more volatile, ugly, toxic cocktail of corruption and human need.
Well, Senator Chris Murphy, the Democrat of Connecticut, who is, very strong on foreign policy, yeah. Seems to be one of the best on foreign policy in the entire United States Senate. And he's been responsible for getting the United States to, at least the Congress, to stop supporting Mohammed bin Salman's destructive war in Yemen. And he wrote on Twitter, "Venezuela didn't just lurch into humanitarian crisis. The aid is being sent there now as part of a regime change strategy. Many are hoping that it will be the match that lights a civil war against Maduro." And I suspect that what Senator Murphy is hinting at there, he's talking about Senator Marco Rubio, John Bolton, Elliot Abrahams, Mike Pence, and Donald Trump.
Yeah, there's no doubt that basically what is being done is this administration is weaponizing humanitarian assistance. This is not humanitarian assistance. It's offered through any multilateral organization, say like the United Nations, or through a non-governmental organization like CARE or Caritas, the Catholic Relief Organization. This is being directed, and the intent is to have it distributed by the opposition. So, the idea is to create some sort of parallel state that can provide much-needed humanitarian assistance to people that are really suffering, but in a way that bolsters the popularity of the Guaido and the opposition coalition, and a way that, and again, there's so many different leaps of logic in this Trump plan. But somehow they seem to be thinking this would spark massive defections by the military once humanitarian aid started to come in through the opposition coalition. So I don't understand the logic of it, but it's clearly an effort, as you just said, Ian, to weaponize, if you will, or to instrumentalize humanitarian assistance in a way that's really going to serve no one's purposes and, again, gets the United States along a path that it's unclear what the next step will be when this military refuses to change sides and the Maduro government refuses to buckle, which is what's been happening.
But in the meantime, it's clearly being used as a campaign theme by President Trump, who was down in Miami, Florida last week, and he has conflated the chaos in Venezuela with socialism here in the United States. And it's clearly he's developing a campaign theme. And so I don't know first of all, it's a pretty absurd claim to think that somehow socialism is about to take over the United States. I don't detect that, and I'm sure you don't. But do you think that, in other words, you've got hawkish people in the administration not thinking this through, having whatever their grudge or whatever their agenda or whatever they feel they have to prove, that's dangerous enough. But then on the other hand, you've got a president who wants to use this situation as a cynical way to put the Democrats on the spot and to gin up this idea that the Democratic Party has become a socialist party, which is also a problem that the Democrats have within their own caucus. They're having a debate about whether they're too progressive or too centrist. And I'm sure Trump is happy to stir the pot in that direction, too.
Yeah, this is why, as I've been saying to my friends, it's a difficult time to be a big D Democrat right now when it comes to Venezuela. You know, one cannot, or one would be a fool, or as you said, brain dead, to deny the cruelty of the Maduro administration and its complete lack of credibility as anything approaching a genuinely leftist government. You know, especially when you have thousands of political prisoners and the military calling the shots. But on the other hand, as you say, this administration is very much using this for electoral means. This goes all the way back to the midterm elections, when the week before the midterm elections, John Bolton traveled to Miami and gave a total red meat speech. Keep in mind, there is the governorship, the Senate position, as well as a number of congressional seats in South Miami that were up, that have large hardline Cuban-American voters. And Bolton gave this red meat speech that was supposed to be a policy speech about Latin America, and only talked about Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, and referred to them alternatively as the Troika of Tyranny, the Three Stooges of Socialism, and the Triangle of Terrorism. It wasn't a policy speech at all. It was simply an electoral speech. And now we see the same thing. Florida has 29 electoral votes. Obama won Florida twice in a row. Trump won Florida in 2016. There's a sense that the way back to the White House for Trump is through Florida. And so he's pulling out all the stops, and by the same token, doing exactly what you said, is trying to make this ridiculous comparison, a parallel between the so-called socialism of Maduro, which isn't socialism, and the social democratic agenda of people like Bernie Sanders and others, and AOC. When in fact, of course, none of the things that they're proposing, even if they aren't your cup of tea, are not anything remotely similar to what the policies that were pursued under Maduro are being pursued under Maduro.
But on the other hand, there are elements in the American left that do seem to have lost their way. You know, it wasn't that long ago in the 80s that the American left were taking a very moral and a correct position opposing dictatorships like Somoza's in Nicaragua, and also the terrible murderous generals in El Salvador and around the world in terms of during the Cold War. We all know that there was a lot of Americans who took a very strong position against the U.S. turning a blind eye in the name of anti-communism to a bunch of hideous leaders. And you can go back even further with Marcos and all of those horrible characters that we supported during the Cold War. But now a lot of elements in the American left support Putin. They think that he's getting a bum rap, and there's sort of McCarthyite attacks on him that are unfounded. And then you've got those that support Maduro as well. So what that seems to me is a sad kind of irony, talking about sad ironies.
Well, I would say it's actually a moral hypocrisy. If what Maduro is doing, again, firing on unarmed civilians, rounding up prisoners, there are detailed cases from Amnesty International, which is by no means a right-wing organization, of torture, arbitrary detention. If any other government from the right were doing this, the left would be on the streets protesting and demanding some sort of action. But again, for reasons I must admit I still struggle to understand, a large part of the left is still confused by anyone who claims to be a socialist and is willing to countenance sorts of gross human rights violations of Maduro and incompetence of Maduro is engaging in simply in the name of the left. As I like to say, if Marcos, Somoza, and let's say Fujimori in Peru were to somehow come back, I think they would watch us and learn the lesson. Like, oh, all I have to do is put on a Che Guevara T-shirt, and I'll get a pass from large segments of the American electorate, including people like Bernie Sanders, who just recently gave some comment of just sort of wishing that humanitarian assistance would enter into Venezuela, but denying the agency of Maduro and not allowing that to happen. So it really confounds, I think, traditional sort of political polls in a way that I think it really undercuts any sides, and especially big D Democrats and even Democratic Socialists professed commitment to democracy and human rights and social development.
Well, in the case of Putin, it's just incomprehensible because the solidarity that the left should have towards Russia is towards the young Russians, the millennials, who go out in the streets and protest this kleptocracy and get beaten up by Putin's goons.
Well, and again, I mean, where is Putin exactly on any of the agenda items that the modern left are their causes? LGBT rights, quite the opposite. Putin has declared that as a big past laws that one can be, LGBT activists can be arrested for supposedly promoting pedophilia and close down pro-LGBT groups. The environment, no, Putin has closed down pro-environment groups that were interfering and engaged, you know, basically looking over the shoulder of the government and its investments. And even on women's rights, where issues on domestic abuse, protections on domestic abuse, against domestic abuse, have been rolled back under Putin. There needs to be, I think, a clear definition of what it means to be of the left today, and a certain moral consistency in how we apply those standards. And a lot of the governments that you mentioned that are sort of being embraced, or at least sort of given a sort of wink and a nod, are ones that simply don't meet those standards by at least U.S. and European standards.
Well, just in closing, what happened in Brazil, how much is that a failure of the left?
Well, this is a whole different issue, and you're absolutely right. The PT was often held up as being a social democratic a party, and indeed, it's not Chavismo, it's not Castrismo, although they may have their affinities. But of course, the time and power from Lula and then later Dilma Rousseff, they became very much a part of the system, a system that has always been deeply corrupted, in which it's been necessary to grease a lot of palms to get legislation passed in the Congress, because it's deeply fractious. There are over 27 political parties in the Brazilian Congress, and it was just sort of very much the modus operandi, if you will, of the Brazilian system. But the PT got caught up in that rather than addressing it. And as a result, we saw the resounding rejection of the PT in the most recent elections, in the 2018 elections. And the problem is this, Ian, is that in the end, what was elected was a man who is, he's unexperienced. He also has ties to corruption, but he was an outsider candidate who was promising people that he'd crack down with an iron fist against criminals and have a shoot first and ask questions later policy for security forces. He's brought in a number of retired and active duty military officers into his government. And again, has said deeply offensive and troubling things about the LGBT community and about ethnic minorities, including indigenous and Afro-Brazilians. So, you know, in the end, the PT, by allowing itself to be so co-opted and corrupted by the system, has really collapsed Brazil's traditional political party system and allowed for the entry into power of a man who, you know, has more in common, say, with Duterte in the Philippines or Orban in Hungary than he does with even the traditional Brazilian right.
Well, Christopher Sabatini, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure, actually. Very good questions. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Sabatini, who's a professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University. And he's a regular contributor to Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy, and most recently published an article on the decline of Venezuela and Brazil's foreign policy ambitions titled "The Sad Death of the Latin American Left." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the pending loss of 10% of the UK's GDP if they crash out of Brexit, and Jeremy Corbyn's announcement that he's prepared to back the people's vote in a new Brexit referendum.
Calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared, and battle come down. London. girl. London calling. Now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania is bitten the dust. London calling. See, we ain't got no swing except for the rain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and is the co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And her latest book is The Future of National Development Banks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
Great to be with you. Great to be with you always, Ian.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. And today, finally, this sort of Hamlet-like leader of the Labour Party has finally made up his mind to support a do-over vote on Brexit, which he's been resisting for some time. So tell us about where we stand, because there's a lot that's not clear. There's not clear what the do-over vote, the choices that will be on the ballot, when it will take place, etc., or whether it will take place. So what's the latest?
Exactly. Well, I think the first part is the fact that the Tory Brexit has been a disaster. I mean, the Prime Minister has, in the last few months, behaved really badly because she keeps negotiating a deal which she knows she will have probably no chance or very little chance of getting through Parliament. And she keeps going back to the EU asking for changes which they're not willing to do, which they have told her many times that they're not willing to do. So she's repeating while the clock is ticking. And there became, I think, a very serious risk of finally that the UK could crash out with no deal, which would be extremely damaging for the British economy. It would probably imply lower GDP by 10% in the next 10 or 15 years by calculations from the same government. And Labour had put this opposition to the current procedures, but it hadn't been very clear on when it would favour a people's vote. So it was already in the declaration from the meeting from the Labour Party from last autumn, but it hadn't been called. And now, pushed both by the incompetence of the Tory party, and I think also, of course, by the leaving of these MPs, who have part largely left, I think, because of their happiness about Brexit, Jeremy Corbyn has now taken the lead and clearly said, well, a number of things. I mean, the Labour position is first of all, his favourite position is to leave, but with a really soft Brexit, which a lot of the EU people like, which is sort of staying in the customs union and staying very close to the single market and respecting the workers' rights and the environmental rights. So he wants to put that to Parliament. Probably that will not be, that will not get through because the Tories will vote against it. But then there are two other amendments which seems that he will support. One is a joint Labour, Yvette Cooper, and Oliver Letwin, who's a Tory, amendment to postpone, to gain time because, you know, so we don't crash out. Which is a very reasonable idea, which the EU leaders now in Sharm el-Sheikh all were telling May that she should do. And thirdly, if Labour's option is defeated, then there is quite a clever amendment by two Labour MPs, which it seems that the leadership may back, that they're called Peter Kyle and Wilson, and they say that they would let her deal, even though they don't particularly like it, because it's not terribly good, but it's not terribly bad either, they would let it pass, provided she took it to a people's vote. And presumably, what people like iVote is that what would be on the ballot, but that's not yet clear, would be either her deal or remain. Yeah.
I see. And her deal is the one that's going nowhere, and you've only got about a month before the crash-out deadline of Brexit.
Exactly. Exactly. And so there is this very big risk that by accident, the country could crash out in a terrible situation. I mean, people talk about, there not being sufficient medicines, airplanes maybe not flying. I personally postponed a trip I had to do for a couple of days because I didn't want to travel immediately after Brexit. I mean, it's so serious. It's completely crazy. And the effect, for example, in the car industry, the Japanese investors like Honda and Nissan, who, were so important to the British economy, one of the big successes of British manufacturing, have started to leave or not invest, or said that they will not invest in the future because they cannot exist with these value chains where the cars are, the production of the cars are integrated so closely with the continent and where they export most of the cars they produce in the UK in the EU market. And all that would completely collapse with a no deal. And it would also, I think, still be bad with her deal, although her deal would be better. The deal that the Labour Party proposes would be even better, but for my mind, staying in the EU is the best deal. Yeah.
Which
but
is.
There is, of course, the politics, whether the people would approve it.
Right. Well, and that's what you would like to see on the ballot, just to go back to Remain.
That's right. That's right.
And again, I'm...
But it is very controversial. I mean, even in the Labour Party, there are a number of MPs who are from the north, from areas where the majority of the people have been Brexiteers. But the majority of young people and the majority of very left-wing people, like around a movement called Momentum, have become very strong Remainers. And I think that's one of the things that has convinced Jeremy Corbyn, because these are the people that campaigned strongly for Corbyn in the general election and that helped him do relatively well, even though he didn't win. And therefore, those people are getting very disaffected. And therefore, I think this will increase unity in the Labour Party. It will increase support for the Labour Party. And hopefully it will lead to an outcome which I think is a rational outcome, which is to remain, although there's still a number of steps to make it happen, like that this referendum or this second people's vote has to be approved by Parliament. And the Tories, this Kyle Amendment, the beauty of the Kyle Amendment is that it has some support amongst Conservatives. Because on their own, the opposition, Labour plus the Lib Dems and so on, do not have enough votes to get things through Parliament. So they need to have, that's why they're offering that it would be her deal versus Remain. Yeah, and that they would theoretically pass her deal subject that the people support. Yeah, it's a bit tricky that.
I see.
But it's also very clever.
So the millennials are a factor that are pressuring Corbyn to ask for the people's vote, another do-over. And also you mentioned the defection of the Labour members. They're threatening to form a centrist bloc, aren't they, of defecting Tories and defecting Labourites?
Well, there's this idea of a centrist party, but I think, the policy ideas are not clear at all because, they have quite different ideas. They're mostly Remainers. That is one thing that they have in common. But, for example, on economic policy, they don't really have very common ideas because the Conservatives, wouldn't want to increase tax on the rich, and so on, whereas the people who have left the Labour Party, several of them, are more progressive. So it's not very clear, what kind of centrist party there will be. There is already a centrist party, which surprisingly hasn't grown very much, which is the Liberal Democrats. So it's not clear whether these new people who have left would join up with the Lib Dems. But I think this has a lot to do with the dissatisfaction of Brexit. And I think the centrist party would have... There are other elements. Some of these people are a bit less progressive or a little bit less leftist than the leadership of the Labour Party on economic policy. But I think the main thing was Brexit. If the Labour leadership really very strongly supports a second referendum, a people's vote, and takes a very active role, then I think they may unite, actually, with Labour. And so I think some of them may be regretting that they left. But I think their leaving may have catalyzed, together with the fact that she, again, was not going to take, a meaningful vote to the House of Commons. I mean, she had initially promised to do that this week, and she delayed it further till 12th of March, which is really completely unacceptable. Because it leaves only 2 weeks before we would crash out of the EU. So I think minds are concentrating, and there's a surge. You know, I feel quite optimistic. I was really down about Brexit, about these MPs leaving. I know some of them, you know, they're good people. I don't agree necessarily with their policies, but it was very sad. But now there seems to be a new energy. So let's hope that things move in a good direction.
So, Stephanie, what does this say about the leadership qualities of Jeremy Corbyn? He sort of vacillated about the original Brexit vote, which in retrospect does look pretty fishy, with these terrible people like Nigel Farage being at the front of it, and then all of this shady financing through Arron Banks and his Russian wife, who's rumored to be an FSB officer. So, I mean...
I didn't know about that, but Nigel Farage's wife is German, and he is assured, apparently, according to the press, German nationality for his kids. So these people are tremendously hypocritical.
Of course.
I think, as one of my journalist colleagues, Will Hutton, says, in a way, Farage became the leader of the Conservative Party, because they, in a way, trying to weaken UKIP, trying to strengthen the Conservative Party, or defend it, both Cameron and May took over more or less the positions of UKIP. And particularly, I think, disappointing was that the Prime Minister, who initially was a very weak Remainer, listened so much to this European Research Group, which is a group of extreme Brexiteers. Extreme, who probably wouldn't mind if the UK crashed out. It's the kind of people that John Major, a previous Conservative Prime Minister, once, without knowing that the microphone was on, called them the bastards, because they have been Eurosceptic for a long time. And so they have become a very, very large group. And the Prime Minister has actually pandered to them quite a lot.
With the Northern Islanders too, right? She's got that small group of very conservative Northern Ireland, what do they call themselves, unionists?
The DUP, yeah, very conservative Protestants were even worse. Right. Even though the majority of people actually in the referendum voted to remain. So this DUP is not representative. As you say, they're a very conservative group of Protestants, who want to have very close ties with the UK. And this issue of Northern Ireland that you've just raised is extremely important.
Right.
I think that's another thing that has finally moved Jeremy Corbyn, and his general has motivated the Labour Party and all reasonable people, the Lib Dems and so on. Because, I mean, a hard Brexit or even, some of these strange arrangements, which would lead to a return of a hard border in between Northern Ireland Ireland and the Republic of Ireland is a great danger to the Good Friday Agreement, that has implied practically an end to violence, which was very serious there. And this is a risk that these Brexiteers don't care about.
But to give the Leave people some credibility, even though I personally think they're a pretty disgraceful and disreputable bunch, and Cameron himself was a absolutely feckless leader, but in many ways Corbyn seems quite feckless. He wasn't exactly a profile of courage when the Brexit vote took place. He waffled on that, but you could at least say that it was the will of the people, in as much as there is a lot of alienation and anger in the UK against politics in general against the political establishment, whether it is liberal, labor, or conservative, similar to the populist revolt here in the United States that exactly. elected Donald Trump. Now, whereas Trump is a catastrophe and still a lot of these people stick by him, if there were a do-over here, particularly once the Mueller report comes out and we learn about Russian involvement and Trump's criminality, then you could re-elect Hillary Clinton. But
exactly.
So to that extent, I have some ambivalence, which might explain Corbyn's waffling. But in this whole sorry saga, where it seems like the one of the most extraordinary self-inflicted political wounds in geopolitical history, you still really are crying out for leadership, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, one of the tragedies, of course, if Brexit were to happen, and particularly if a hard Brexit would happen, the people who voted for Brexit and the people who voted for Trump in the same way, if his policies are when his policies are being implemented, are the ones that are going to be most damaged. Because the rich can leave or put their money abroad, but it's the working class people who will be most damaged, and they're the ones that that voted like that. But I think one has to say, in the British case, that these people were terribly lied to. I mean, the dominant press, you know, is very conservative. They completely lied. There is a tradition in British politics of always blaming the EU. Even Tony Blair, who was the most pro-EU prime minister, was always very tepid towards the EU. Yeah, and previous prime ministers like Margaret Thatcher, she was in favor of the single market, which she actually helped to invent, were always battling with the EU, battling for Britain. And so they spread this idea that the EU was a problem and not the solution. And Jeremy Corbyn was initially from that tradition, because a lot of the left initially was critical of the EU. And there are some reasons as well. But to be fair to Jeremy Corbyn, I think he perhaps could have campaigned more strongly, but he did campaign and he campaigned well to remain. I mean, you know, the people who, and most Labour people voted to remain. The people who voted to leave were basically Tories. And some Labour people in the North, these disaffected people that you spoke. And I think Corbyn has been somewhat slow, perhaps, in taking up this flag, although for over a year now they have had this position that they wanted a soft Brexit, a very soft Brexit, which is a sort of Brexit without really leaving too much, because if you're in the customs union, you solve the Northern Ireland problem, you solve the problem of the value chains of the car industry, there's still some other issues left. And also if you maintain workers' rights and environmental rights, and they want to stay in the European institutions, which is another very important thing, like the exchange of students. Sure. You know, millions of students cross the borders to study in other European countries and to create, you know, European mentality.
Right. So, well, just in closing, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, Stephanie, about you mentioned the lies that brought about Brexit. So in the rogues gallery that I mentioned of Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks, you have to add Rupert Murdoch, surely.
Exactly, who is not even British and who has for decades been pushing against the EU. And of course, there are also these very right-wing conservatives like Boris Johnson, for example, doesn't care for business. It's not only that they don't care for workers, they don't care for business. I mean, it's a completely kind of nationalist ideology. He said, F business. I mean, he was a foreign secretary. And this man who leads this extreme right-wing group, who has up between 60 and 80 MPs, Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, who doesn't really care about peace in Ireland or the prosperity of working class people. I mean, there are a number of rogues, and they lied all the time. So you can't blame the people who voted like that wrongly, because they were really very badly informed, particularly by the right-wing press, which is very dominant.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
As always, a great pleasure.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. And again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who's Emeritus Fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at Sussex University and the Associate Fellow at the Overseas Development Institute in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University and the co-editor with Joseph Stiglitz of A Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And her latest book is The Future of National Development Banks. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the controversy over the Green Book winning Best Picture at last night's Academy Awards ceremony, as opposed to Spike Lee's Black Klansman.
Cottage small beside a field of grain.
Burn, Hollywood, burn. I smell a riot going on. First the guilty, now the gone. Yeah, I'll check out a movie, but it'll take a black one to move me. Get me the hell away from this TV. All this news and views are beneath me. So all I hear about is shots ringing out. About gangs putting each other's hand out. So I'd rather kick some slang out. All right, fellas, let's go hang out. Hollywood or would they not make us all look bad?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rashad Robinson, the Executive Director of Color of Change, a recognized expert on how popular culture impacts American attitudes and values. He has served as a thought leader, widely sought-out speaker, strategist, and leader on holding public figures accountable and utilizing media to shift public opinion concerning progressive and civil rights issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rashad Robinson.
Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Rashad. And you've been tweeting out about the Academy Awards, and there's a bit of a, I don't know how you describe it, furor, flap, something's going on between over the fact that the Green Book won the Best Picture at last night's Academy Awards, and the Spike Lee movie, Black Klansman, didn't. And frankly, I thought that Black Klansman was a really powerful movie and a very relevant one. And Barbara Streisand, who introduced the movie in last night's telecast, indicated the same. But on the other hand, I thought The Green Book was a good movie too. So I was ambivalent. But how did last night's Oscar ceremony strike you?
Well, you know, I think there were a number of movies that sort of in telling the story of race or racial justice or even painting sort of a diverse lens could have actually been much more of a sign that the Academy gets it than Green Book. Just the title alone, which Green Book as a movie had nothing to do with the Green Book. For your listeners that don't know, Green Book was a publication that was actually for African Americans traveling to the South to sort of let them know where they could stay, where they could eat in Jim Crow era South. And the book really wasn't about that. There was a lot of also controversy about the portrayal of Dr. Shirley in not so much Mahershala Ali's performance, but actually how the story was written, and that there was some controversy from the family. There was an image that was tweeted out after the awards of sort of the kind of, six white men collecting the award about a film on racism in the South. And I think in many ways, that summed up probably a lot of people's frustration on a night that had so many celebrations of diversity, that the night would sort of end with an award that was really about racism through the lens of white people, kind of Disney-fied in some respects, and a story that the black family didn't actually support.
Well, is that to say, though, Rashad Robinson, that white people simply can't capture the essence of the black struggle, particularly in the Jim Crow South?
No, it's saying the Green Book didn't capture it.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of people loved A Color Purple. I personally love the movie A Color Purple. And there are many other films that, you know, white folks have been able to do well in capturing. But also, we're in 2019, and we're having a conversation about, ongoing conversation about diversity, and oftentimes, who gets to tell these stories? Who gets greenlit to tell these stories? Whose voice is prioritized? All of those things are decisions that we can't take race out of the equation in terms of who gets to make it. And so we can have a conversation about Green Book, you know, following a long line of sort of films, you know, Driving Miss Daisy sort of winning the Academy Award the same year that Do the Right Thing came out. You have these sort of moments where oftentimes the Academy and white America feels more comfortable with a certain type of portrayal of race, a certain type of portrayal of racial dimensions. And I think that for many, you know, in 2019, in a year where Black Panther made more money in the U.S. than any other film, in a year where you had, you know, Spike Lee, you know, with a huge movie, and you had a number of other movies out throughout the year that didn't even get recognized at the Academy, you know, I do think that there's a there was some disappointment in seeing Green Book, you know, a movie about race through the lens of white folks being celebrated as you know, in that way.
Well, what you just said, Rashad Robinson, Spike Lee did actually made a mention of how he's sort of cursed by movies about driving, Driving Miss Daisy, and the Green Book about an Italian-American driving an African-American musician through the Jim Crow South. And, of course, in both occasions, his movies were up against the driving movies. So he was kind of irritated. He sort of turned his back. But I think, you know, he ultimately ended up having good humor, which is kind of his style, really. He's not a kind of bitter person, from what I can tell. But there was one movie that I thought was amazing, and that was The Hate U Give, and it of course, didn't get nominated. So the whole thing is a bizarre system, the voting, and they're about to really get rid of some of the most important categories, which are unique to filmmaking, cinematography and film editing, and relegate them to the commercials. But there was an uproar against them. So what was your opinion on how the ceremonies were in general, given the kind of apparent confusion at the Academy itself in terms of, you know, trying things and then reversing themselves, etc.?
Well, I mean, I think they had a lot of confusion heading into the show, from even not having a host after the, you know, the debacle around Kevin Hart. And that probably gave them more space to actually be able to put more awards on when you don't have sort of many of those bits that a comedic host oftentimes has throughout the show. You probably have more time for awards. And so, you know, I thought the show moved rather quickly. I thought it gave them an opportunity to have and showcase a sort of diverse array of Hollywood celebrities, from sort of your, you know, well-known established folks like Julia Roberts or Queen Latifah, but also having more up-and-coming folks from, you know, movies like Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther, and being able to see, you know, many of those stars that represented the sort of next wave of Hollywood. I thought that that was exciting, and I thought that was really good for the audience. And, you know, I think overall, you know, being able to see movies like Black Panther and Roma do so well in variety of in a range of categories, I think is important. I think it's important for film. I think it's important to send a message about the type of diverse stories, portrayal that we should get to see on screen. And so I hope that this is a sign of things to come. I'm old enough to remember the year that, you know, Halle Berry and Denzel Washington won for Best Actress and Best Actor, respectively, in the same Academy Awards. And people thought that suddenly doors would be open and things would change. And, you know, over a decade later, we're, you know, in Oscar So White era. So I do know that presence does not mean power, and that power is the ability to change the rules. And so much of what has to happen in Hollywood is deeper levels of transparency, of more changing of how Hollywood does its business, of a recognition of all the ways that systemic exclusion from what happens behind the camera to what gets greenlit means that there are certain stories that simply don't get told. But, you know, so many of the creatives that are getting a chance and building their own platform and building their own businesses to tell more stories, from the Ryan Cooglers to the Ava DuVernays and Jordan Peeles, I just think that there's a lot more hope and optimism. And that does not mean that doesn't need to be continued to be pushed, but there's hope and optimism that the type of stories that we all deserve to see will hopefully come to light.
Well, of course, the president is not taking us in that direction. He tweeted out a rather nasty tweet against Spike Lee. But just in closing, what did you think of the fact that the Green Book was introduced by the civil rights icon, Congressman John Lewis?
Well, you know, you don't get better than Congressman John Lewis. He is one of our true living legends and icons, and I just have such a tremendous amount of gratitude for everything that he represents.
Right, but wasn't he giving the movie his stamp of approval?
He may have been, and, you know, and that doesn't mean that we have to agree on everything, but I have such a tremendous amount of respect for Congressman Lewis and everything that he has done and sacrificed, and at the same time, I can look at a movie like Green Book and believe that in 2019, it was probably a movie that deserved just a bit of a different spin. And more importantly, could have been an important movie maybe if it had had a different title and a different rollout. But I think the title of it being named after the Green Book, which was such an important piece of Black American and American history about what it meant to be Black and travel through the South as someone who grew up in Eastern Long Island, but spent a lot of time going back and forth to the South growing up and heard the stories of my family on the Great Migration in the 20s and 30s, and the stories of my family going back and forth and what it meant to be able to, like, have to judge when you could stop someplace and eat or use the bathroom. Naming that book the Green Book without ever really going into the Green Book, and also sort of the movie itself, that sort of the storyline, I just think it could have been done differently. And I think that for a lot of people, their feelings about the movie were colored through that lens. And I think that it will be sort of a message, I think, hopefully, to Hollywood, that this doesn't mean that you can't tell those stories. It just does mean that I do think that more nuance is required.
Well, Rashad Robinson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rashad Robinson, who's the Executive Director of Color of Change, a recognized expert on how popular culture impacts American attitudes and values. He has served as a thought leader, widely sought-out speaker, strategist, and leader on holding public figures accountable and utilizing media to shift public opinion concerning progressive and civil rights issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.